morning. We have, four bills to consider. We're going to take House Bill 3085 first, and House Bill, Senate Bill 233A second, Senate Bill 218A third, and Senate Bill 219 fourth. So with that in mind, I'll open the work session on House Bill 3085. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 3085 was before this committee April 18th. There's been some changes made since that time, which are reflected in the -4 amendments. The bill with those amendments do several things. First off, they require the state agencies to pay the attorney's fees, costs, and disbursements in civil cases where they lose and are unable to show that the challenge agency action was substantially justified. The -4 amendments exclude from the definition of civil judicial proceeding any proceeding to establish, modify, or enforce child support obligations or any related proceedings. They also exclude tort claims. -4 amendments also change the term meaningful to significant in the definition of in favor of the petitioner. It clarifies the definition of the term substantially justified from the original bill. Provide procedural requirements necessary to obtain attorney fees. They require the courts and at the request of either party to make special findings of fact and state its conclusion of laws on the record regarding the issues material to award the denial of attorney fees. It provides that the court may not rely on factors specified in ORS 20.075-1 and ORCP 68 in determining whether to award attorney fees, and it provides that an agency must pay petitioner's attorney's fees and costs, including expert witness fees, when the agency withdraws an order for the purposes of reconsideration and modifies or reverses the order in favor of petitioner.
Thank you. I can give the committee a little bit of procedural history of this because I think it's going to be at least my suggestion that we move this to the full committee for a deeper discussion, but this bill arose out of a decision from the Court of Appeals which construed some existing attorney fee statutes. We have spent a lot of time on this bill, and lo and behold, last week, I guess on April 28, the Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals and set out in a very definitive decision an analysis of the existing attorney fee statutes, which applies specifically to administrative agency proceedings. I guess what I would like to do is have a greater discussion of that Supreme Court decision when we go into full committee to have the benefit of the full committee. Note that the -4 amendments which are before you are very, very broad in terms of their application to civil judicial proceedings, accepting only criminal proceedings, proceedings on a tort claim, and proceedings to modify child support obligations. It seems to me that would take in all other civil and administrative adjudications. And if that's where the committee wants to go, that's fine, but I think perhaps I'd like to have the benefit of the full committee's thinking on the sweeping nature of it. It also changes the test for the award of attorney's fees to one which is, I think, new to the Oregon statutes, and I'm kind of worried about and want a discussion about the precedent that, or the fact that we, if we want to change existing law as substantially as this. But I did tell the sponsors that it would be my position to move it to the full committee so we could have the discussion which I've outlined and address any other concerns of the committee. So with that, motion. President Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I would move the -4s into House Bill 3085.
Representative Garrard moves the -4 amendments into House Bill 3085. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just have a clarifying question. I don't have a copy of the -2s or -3s, and it looks to me as though probably that they're incorporated into the -4s.
Is that I know right? Yes, that's true.
Okay. That's all I need to know.
Okay. Any objection? If not, that's allowed. On the main motion, the Chair will move House Bill 3085 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Originally, when we heard this bill on 328, there was a $9 million impact on state agencies. At least I have that note here. I'm just wondering how much the amendments may affect that particular dollar figure and whether a fiscal is necessary on this bill.
I think that's a good question, President Garrard, because as I mentioned, the existing law only applied to administrative agency proceedings, which are a very narrow spectrum of all litigation that the state could be involved in. This bill is sweeping in that it takes in all civil judicial proceedings except criminal, torts, and child support collections. That's, with exceptions, are very narrow. Maybe the best thing to do would be to invite some testimony at the full committee on the fiscal. And with that, pass the bill up, so at least we get a sense that we're moving the bill.
That's fine with me, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and I appreciate that suggestion. And once again, I'm kind of at a loss that our administrative agency is not coming forth fast enough on some of these issues, but I've made that statement before, and we'll invite testimony on the fiscal when it goes to the full committee. Further discussion from the committee? Hearing none, then the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores excused. Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth excused or absent?
Absent.
Thank you. Representative Critter?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 3085, as amended, is forwarded to the committee with the due pass recommendation. With the understanding we'll invite testimony on the fiscal implications, and I hope that someone will take care of that. That's not something I usually do. Counsel?
Yes.
Okay. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3085.
What did you need?
Which one am I doing anyway?
233.
I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 233A. Counsel.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 233A comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. The changes in this bill come as a result of the juvenile code split into sections on delinquency and dependency. This bill is meant to add language to consistently state the underlying policies of the delinquency code. Specifically, it requires the Oregon Youth Authority to use case planning for use with its jurisdictions to ensure public safety and reduction of juvenile delinquency. It amends the juvenile code to reflect public safety, accountability, and reformation principles. It repeals various statutory terms to reflect the public safety, accountability, and reformation principles of the delinquency code in the place of terms used to reflect the best interest of the child policy. It changes the wording in statutes that describe the contents of reports that OIA submits to the courts and the Citizen Review Board, and allows the courts to withhold information in the youth reformation plan from the youth or the youth's parents in certain circumstances. It also updates the process of review hearings for youth offenders and includes parties such as the court-appointed special advocates, the OIA, the Citizen Review Board, and the district attorney.
Thank you, counsel. We have one witness, Ms. Johnson. Would you like to come forward?
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. Thank you for hearing this bill this morning. This is what we call the Juvenile Code Split Bill, Senate Bill 233. For the last couple of sessions, the Law Commission has had a Juvenile Code Split Bill each session that works on cleaning up these chapters. As some of you may remember, the Juvenile Code was split into chapters 419A, 419B, and 419C. 419A being a combination materials for both dependency and delinquency, 419B being the dependency chapter, and 419C being the delinquency chapter. This bill is regarding the latter, 419C, the delinquency chapter. Just a little bit of background. This bill does come to you from the Law Commission. It was recommended by the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group, which is composed of DAs and defense attorneys, juvenile department members, as well as agency members from including OIA and DHS. So it is a consensus bill that is really a cleanup bill. This bill does focus on a couple of areas, all regarding OIA. The first section clarifies that the focus is on reformation and public safety. It's not on the rational relationship to the jurisdictional findings, which is more associated with dependency. So it allows the court to require treatment. For example, it covers the whole child. This is a result of the split, that the distinctions were not made clearly. Sections 2 and 3 are more LC-type cleanups, and then Section 4 through the rest of the bill have to deal with the reports that OIA has to file. It clarifies that parents are allowed to request a hearing, and it does not require a report every so many days as the statute was before. Rather, it requires the court to order a report. So it will cut some costs, but it will make the process more efficient in terms of the reporting that OIA is required. That's pretty much it of what the bill is. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Garrard.
Ms. Johnson, could I just have a quick reader's digest of this bill?
Sure. The two, Representative Garrard, Chair Ackerman, the two main areas of this bill are to clarify that OIA and its case planning can treat the whole child rather than some sort of rational relationship to the jurisdictional findings, which is what is presently in statute. But right now, OIA is treating the whole child, but the statutory language is not exactly clear that that's allowed. So, for example, if the youth were found to have committed a robbery but really has an alcohol problem, they'd be able to treat the alcohol issue as well as the robbery issue. The second part of the bill has to do with the reports that are required by OIA to file with the court. The bill allows the court to require reports at any time, but doesn't require every so many days as presently required. It allows the court to monitor the case as needed. And lastly, it allows the youth, the DA, the youth's parent to request a hearing, a review hearing. And right now, the DA and the child's parent are left off the list.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Further questions from the committee? Thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you.
I have no other witnesses unless someone likes to raise their hand and come forward. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 233A and open a work session on Senate Bill 233A. The chair will move that Senate Bill 233A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee? Seeing none, the clerk will call a roll.
Representative Flores excused. Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth absent. Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 233A is forwarded to the full committee with the due pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill. With that, the work session on Senate Bill 233A is concluded, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 218A.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 218A allows a public servant or a public servant's employer to seek an injunction or restraining order against a person engaging in the following conduct: obstruction of governmental or judicial administration, assault, menacing, criminal trespass in the first degree, disorderly conduct, harassment, and telephonic harassment. This bill basically allows public employees to stop people who are threatening them or other violent individuals from doing that, continuing to do so.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Neely, with the Department of Justice and Attorney General Hardy Meyer's office. Senate Bill 218 comes to you from the Attorney General, and as Counsel Sears indicated, this provides a what we believe is a streamlined ability for public bodies to go out and secure an injunction in instances in which the employees of that public body have been threatened with violence. Unfortunately, as we all know, that does happen now with more regularity than it has in the past. Sometimes this violence can indeed escalate to a situation when an employee is in significant harm. One of the questions that has come up time to time is, why are we going to afford this special privilege to public servants? And I think the answer to that question is, in fact, public servants don't have, in many instances, the discretion as to whether or not they're going to actually provide services to our community members. In fact, they're, in many instances, mandated by law to provide those services. And so, again, in those instances in which you have a public official who has no choice but to provide a service, we think that they are, in fact, entitled to a small amount of extra protection here, and that's the ability to get an injunction as is defined in this law. I would bring forth some examples, but I don't unfortunately have them right at hand. We did get some examples on the other side. Most of them come from the Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Forestry, in which you actually have instances in which an individual is, in fact, threatened with serious violence. I would add, from the experience at the Department of Justice, we regularly have similar threats in our Division of Child Support. There may, in fact, be instances in which it would be beneficial to have this streamlined approach. One other item in closing. Under current law, we have, in fact, found a way to protect these employees when we do have the threat of violence. Unfortunately, the process we've undertaken, which I can't describe fully, and I apologize, I'm pinch-hitting for the attorney who has handled these cases, that process is a lengthy, time-consuming process in some instances. Again, we believe that this provides a more streamlined process for us to get this injunction in the instances in which you have severe threats against public employees. If you'd have any questions regarding this legislation, I'd be more than happy to try to answer them.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Olson.
Mr. McNeely, I guess I'm can understand the reasoning for the bill to some degree, but I'm curious, why would a person not pursue a restraining order if you've got a lot of this type of conduct going on?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Olson, I think that would be one possibility. Again, this gives the flexibility for the employer to do that. So, in fact, it's an opportunity for a public employer to take a proactive approach to protecting their employees. This is conduct that occurs in the course of the daily work of a public employee, and it seems from our standpoint as though, the public body ought to be able to protect their employees, as opposed to the employees independently outside of the work environment having to secure this sort of protection and this sort of injunction. I do think there are instances in which an employee, again, as a private citizen, may be able to go out and get such an injunction, but our attorneys tell me that has been a complex process on the four or five occasions that's happened in the past couple years.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Yes, Representative Girard.
I guess I got the same problem. I don't know what would prevent a public servant or a public servant's employer from getting an injunction without this bill or a restraining order.
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, the Department of Justice believes we don't currently have the authority as a public employer to immediately seek that injunction. And I apologize, as I said, I'm pinch hitting for the attorney who usually handles this. He's in court this morning. But if you'd like me to get more clarification on that, I can. Again, I think that the fundamental underlying issue here is that our department doesn't believe they currently, in law, have that authority. And I can't give you any more details on that. I apologize.
Further questions from the committee? President McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Neely, I realize that this is not your subject matter here, and you're just you're presenting it in someone else's absence. I do notice that the definition of public servant includes not only the public officer or employee, but also includes, under the cross-reference in the bill, to another ORS section, a person serving as an advisor, consultant, or assistant at the request or direction of the state, any political subdivision thereof, or any governmental instrumentality. So the way I would read it is that the public servant or the employer can petition, and that public servant could include an outside party. So you could have someone who is serving as, say, counsel in a lawsuit, a private attorney retained by the state because of a conflict or some staffing issue at DOJ, who is subject to this kind of threat, and then would have the right to use this process, which it seems maybe just fine, but I just have observed that it maybe is broader than, in fact, I think it is broader than just the public servant who is a public employee having this authority.
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, I concur. We have looked closely at which definition of public servant we're going to use, and in fact, when this bill was in committee in the Senate, we expanded the definition to also include elected officials. I think that the goal of using this definition was to sweep in the volunteers that work for the state, and that was one of our key concerns, is there are many instances in which you have volunteers who are working on very, very sensitive issues, and we wanted to be sure that they had the opportunity to enjoy the same protections that a normal paid employee of the state would have. I agree with you that it would sweep in some of those folks that do have a contract relationship with the state, and I can go back to our office and again find clarification as to exactly how far that inclusion would extend. I don't know off the top of my head, but I know that our intention was to find a definition that included volunteers.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative. Further questions from the committee? I just have a couple on, it seems to me that this is partially based upon our domestic abuse model, where you can go to court, get an ex parte order, it's served, and then the responding party has a time period within which to object. I haven't had a chance to review that proceeding, but it seems to me that this bill doesn't have anything about the process, which is how things are not how things are served upon the respondent, as much as what the notices should say in the order about applying for a hearing within 30 days. Do you have an answer to that, or how would it be accomplished?
Chair Ackerman, I do. This process, as described in this bill, would be exactly the process that we would anticipate you'd go through in the course of getting a FAPA restraining order. So I think, again, I don't know what the exact timelines are in the FAPA situation or in the elder abuse restraining orders, but I do know that we had this discussion on the other side, and that in the course of that discussion, it was determined that, in fact, though not explicitly laid out in the statute, it did all of the terms under the FAPA restraining order are applicable to this restraining order. I can get you additional details again.
Okay, thank you. Further questions from the committee on the testimony? If not, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a question of counsel. What was the Senate vote on this bill?
I believe the vote was unanimous on this bill, but I would have to check that. Maybe Mr. Neely knows.
It was unanimous, both out of committee and on the floor, and I would add that this bill did happen to come up auspiciously the day after you had an unwanted guest in one of the chambers. Again, the bill was already scheduled at that time. It just happened to be fortuitous.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions of the witness? Very good. Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 218A? Okay. Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 218A and have a work session on that bill. Motion? Okay, then the chair will move that Senate Bill 218A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair, this looks like a good bill to me. It doesn't look like it does anything differently than what existing law would do for the power of the public servant to bring a, to invoke this remedy or to get this protection, but by extending it to the agency so that they can act on behalf of the public servant. That seems like that's a desirable expansion of the right.
Okay, further discussion from the committee. Hearing none, then the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores is excused. Representative Garrard?
No.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
And Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Krieger, do you want to vote on this?
I have to. Aye.
House Senate Bill 218A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill. Closed work session on Senate Bill 218A. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 219.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 219 expands the authority of the Attorney General to exempt interstate and certain other intergovernmental agreements by state agencies from legal review. Right now, the Attorney General reviews all such agents, such agreements to ensure that they are valid and they're not illegal. The class of such contracts that are exempted from that legal review is very narrow. This bill would broaden that, basically allowing contracts that are low-risk contracts to go through without this review so that the Attorney General can focus its time on more high-risk type of contracts.
Mr. Neely?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Track members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, Oregon Department of Justice. Senate Bill 219 is a bill that helps to streamline our processes and, in fact, streamline government. It will save agencies that we work with some money. As Counsel Sears indicated, right now, under current law, with very, very limited exceptions, the Attorney General's Office, through its business transactions section, reviews and authorizes as legally sufficient an array of interstate agreements. What this bill does is it gives us additional authority to exempt some of the more mundane but important to those agencies agreements that our office has traditionally reviewed. A good example of the type of agreement that we might be authorizing the agency to enter into without Attorney General legal sufficiency review are those agreements by the Oregon University System in the course of athletic competitions. The committee may not know this, but in fact, every single time a university plays an out-of-state game, we in fact have to approve an interstate agreement for the playing of that athletic competition. And so, as you can imagine, the university system is probably not all that plussed with paying for our legal services for each one of these essentially routine interstate agreements. This bill would authorize us to, in fact, allow the university to move forward on those. I would also alert the committee. The Attorney General takes very, very seriously our review of legal sufficiency for all contracts and interstate agreements, and I would expect the Attorney General to, in the course of authorizing exemptions from that process, look very carefully at whether or not there is any risk to the state. Again, I think that the goal behind this bill, however, is to find a way not only to save agencies time and money, but the state time and money, and we think this is a very good bill, again, and should merit your strong support.
Questions for the committee? I just had one small one. Do you exempt these agreements now just by some word from the Attorney General, or is it actually proceed by through the rulemaking process?
Mr. Chair, our exemptions are generally done by rulemaking.
You would anticipate that with
I would anticipate that with this as well.
Thank you very much. That would allow then public input to the change, of course.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you. A further discussion on Senate Bill 219. Hearing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 219 and open a work session on that bill. Motion? Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 219 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves Senate Bill 219 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Thank you. Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Senate Bill 219 is afforded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with Representative Gerard as its carrier. I will close the work session on that bill. Further business to come before the committee? Seeing none, then we are adjourned. Record time. Thank you.